You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1991 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother George Booker on the subject, The Revelation of Jesus Christ.
I just want to summarize a bit what I went through very quickly yesterday about earth and heaven, and we're going to look at clean up several little points that perhaps I should have made, but I omitted in my haste. And then we want to move forward to look at some Bible passages in the book of Revelation, and I'm not going to assert, but I'm going to suggest, and we're going to test that suggestion as to the possibility that this particular view of earth and heaven suits the context and helps explain some passages in the book. Now, back on page 20, remember we were talking about those nations that occupy that territory. This is only a small portion of that territory. As you can see, the inset map that belongs in the larger map on page 20, that area between Egypt and Assyria, or between the Nile River and the Euphrates River, and in the midst of that area, there is, of course, the land of Israel, surrounded as it has been in the past. It is today, in large measure, by basically 10 nations. We could differ somewhat in how we count them and how we subdivide, but as it was in Psalm 83, in a very similar way it is today, Israel is surrounded by 10 nations who are bent on eliminating the nation of Israel. And I didn't put this overhead up yesterday, but I think it helps illustrate Psalm 83. The names that are in black are those 10 nations that are mentioned in Psalm 83, I think it's verses 6 through 8, those who are confederate together with one express purpose that they would destroy the nation of Israel, and there would be no more nation by that name. And then the names that are in blue would be, as best we can say, the modern equivalents on a territorial basis for those nations that are mentioned in Psalm 83. We don't have quite, maybe we do, about 10 or maybe 7 or 8 that are shown in this picture, with the understanding that the land itself in which these Arab peoples dwelt was also, as the first map on page 20 shows us, going considerably more to the east, into the area of the Euphrates River. And what I should have pointed out also is we're talking about the earth and these kings of the earth or kings of the land and the number 10 and its significance. 10 is mentioned, there are 10 nations mentioned in Genesis 15 verses 19 through 21. Another 10 nations mentioned in Psalm 83. The Bible suggests to us by various passages that as time went by, the 10 nations that are mentioned in Psalm 83 in large measure amalgamated with the 10 nations in Genesis 15 to form basically the people that exist in that territory today, the Arab nations, who are an amalgamation of some descendants and relatives of Abraham and other Canaanite peoples who dwelt in the land. And along with that, we should look at a passage. I'm holding up my Bible, but really we can use the handout. Revelation 17, verses 12 and 16, refer to the 10 horns that were attached to the last great beast that persecuted and destroyed God's people. I'm paraphrasing in very general terms so as to avoid prejudicing the discussion. Chapter 17 and verse 12, the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings which have not yet received power, but they will receive authority as kings for a short time. I think that's what 1 hour must mean. And then again, the 10 horns are mentioned in verse 16. So we have the biblical interpretation of the 10 horns, that they represent 10 kings that, along with the beast, are intent on destroying God's people. I'm trying to be as careful in those expressions as possible, but suggesting that we may have a quite remarkable fit between what Revelation has to say and what we see in the world around us, particularly in the Middle East. And again, after having seen that first map, the second one, I think, makes more sense. And I just put it up there again briefly to remind you. The fig tree in red, the nation of Israel founded in 1948, and all the trees around it in this same area, this area that we're calling the earth or the land, maybe more precisely by definitions. And there they are again, the same nations generally we were talking about before with the dates in which they became independent, or in which, in biblical terms, they budded forth and showed life. Now, along with that, I should have mentioned, and I didn't really, on page 21, I glossed over that, the quotation from Daniel chapter 2. And obviously, as we all know, there are many connections between the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation. Daniel pictures in chapter 2 the four great, we could say world empires, but basically they were empires that in turn, in biblical history, dominated the nation of Israel. And that's what made them significant. And that's why they are listed rather than the Mayan Empire or the Aztec Empire or the Chinese Empire that went on and on and on through history. They are the empires that were relevant to the nation of Israel. And then we come to what would be a portion of the fourth beast, or maybe a separate category depending on how far we want to stretch the point. And that would be, as described in Daniel 2 verses 41 through 43, the feet and the toes of that image, the very last part, the little part at the very end or the very bottom. And as Daniel recounts the story, these kingdoms will be divided. Some of them will be weak. Some of them will be strong. As much as you saw the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be strong and broken, partly strong, partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. They shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. The four words that are in bold type and underlined are the same word. It is the word Ereb, which is directly related to the word Arab. It may be a coincidence. Some people have said that's all it is. Or it may be a pointer. Now, a question arises. Is there any connection between the Arab nations of today and the Roman Empire? Because certainly as we look at the four portions of the image working down to that, we come to the Roman Empire. There is at least a connection, and you can judge for yourself how important it is. And that is that the Roman Empire, and we could have a map up on the overhead again, occupied all that area where the Arab nations were, as well as occupying the area where the nation of Israel was. And so a remnant of the Roman Empire, if we want to look at it that way, would be that Middle Eastern area where the Arab nations have now come into existence, independence and strength to some extent, and certainly antagonism toward Israel in the very last days. It's often been remarked that the symbolism of Daniel chapter 2 requires that the whole image stand on its feet. And certainly there could be elements of other nations involved in a great antagonism leading to a great war or wars against the people of Israel. And we could certainly see how various nations could be brought into the picture, including Rome and the power that is to be found in Rome. But another interesting point is this, and I wish I had illustrated it with an overhead, but it would have required a bit of manipulation, but I think you can visualize this. The four great empires that are mentioned in Daniel 2, let's make sure I get them right, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, each occupied, and we see these maps in the back of our Bibles, each occupied vast areas. But as I said earlier, what they have in common is each one of those in turn subjugated, and the Roman was the worst of all in AD 70, subjugated and finally destroyed the nation of Israel and the city of Jerusalem. So if you think of those four nations and their those four empires and the territory they occupied, and you say, what area do all four of those overlap in? In other words, the Babylonian and the Persian empires came from the east, and they went into the Middle East, and they controlled Israel and the land of Israel. The Grecian and the Roman empires came from the west, occupied a lot of area, but they also came into the Middle East, and they controlled this area that we keep looking at on the map. What was the area where all four of those overlapped? And the answer, interestingly, is the very same area we keep seeing on the map. So perhaps the way in which the whole image comes together is we look at that very territory, that extended land, and that's the proper word, in which all four of those empires exercised dominion, the very area that God was most concerned with. And we look to that area again, and what do we see? We see 10 kings, the remnant of those previous empires, a mixed and mingled people. That's the very meaning of their nationality, their ethnic group. And they, I would say, are the point in the spear pointed toward Israel. And once again, the image there in the Middle East. The vestiges of that image in the last days. Over to page 23, we're talking about earth and land, and a reference that I should have mentioned because I find it very important, at the very bottom of page 23, talking about symbolic meanings of heavens and earth. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. And we all realize, and we're well equipped to argue in various ways, that passages such as this don't mean that the literal earth on which we stand, that literal globe, is ever going to be destroyed. That's the eternal home of the righteous. Don't ask me questions about beyond the millennium. That doesn't really enter into our picture at this point. So we know that in this sense, heaven and earth are not literal, and that helps us realize that we need to attach some symbolic meaning in various Bible passages to help us understand here. And Isaiah 65, from which this is quoted, remember we talked about that earlier, by parallelism suggests that heaven means Jerusalem, where God's heavenly throne was established, his holy or heavenly place, and the earth represents the people all around who are subject to the glory of God and the will of God coming forth from that heavenly place. And we get that by looking carefully at Isaiah 65. On over to page 24, still think of this as summary and reminding us from yesterday. On over to page 24, we analyze some of the passages that had to do with earth. There are other words that could have been used that would have suggested a much broader area, but they weren't used hardly at all in the book of Revelation. We have this word gay. I hope I'm pronouncing that reasonably accurately. And then at the bottom of page 24, I think I glossed over this too, the other passages using this Greek word, some have to do with the seals, some have to do with the trumpets, some have to do with the vials and bowls. Five of them have to do with the witnesses. Five have to do with the dragon. Six have to do with the beast. So every main character in the book of Revelation and all of the successive judgments of God, the seals, the trumpets, and the vials, and the bowls, have to do with this ge, or this eretz. And so we're not talking about some limited part of the book of Revelation. Once we look at this, we're talking about practically the whole of the book is enacted, is worked out in this eretz, or this ge, this land that has certain boundaries. Maybe the boundaries sort of blur off. We can't be exactly sure where to draw those precise lines, but we know the general area that we're talking about. In Isaiah 65, and it's quoted so we don't have to look it up, it's written down on the top of page 25, "Behold, I create new heavens and a new earth. The former shall not be remembered. I create Jerusalem a rejoicing and her people a joy." 2 Peter chapter 3 refers to the same Old Testament passage, or else perhaps it refers to what is already written in the book of Revelation. So these terms are plainly figurative. We're talking about new heavens and a new earth. We're talking about the recreation of Jerusalem, the repeopling of the land with those people who are repentant and righteous. So, turn to page 29, and you have a map there. Think of this as a summary. And again, we're still testing this to see how well it works. And there's the equivalent. We can point out certain things. The land that is darkened there is basically the land from the Euphrates to the Nile. Within that land are eretz. There are the nation of Israel today and basically 10 nations that are Arab nations who would seek to destroy it. This land has four corners, interestingly, based on Revelation 7. And Revelation 20, Ezekiel chapter 7, and perhaps Ezekiel 38 and 39. And at the four corners of that land, there are Gog and its allies, not actually in the land, but just beyond it. We're talking about Turkey and perhaps Russia further to the north. We're talking about Persia or Iran to the east, about Ethiopia, called Cush in Ezekiel 38 and elsewhere, just to the south, and Libya just to the west. So those four corners of the land That's precisely the word used in Revelation 7 and Revelation 20. Those four corners of the land help to define the land that we're discussing. Now, other ideas arise. We're still going to talk about heaven as it occurs sometimes in the book of Revelation to see if it fits. But we have the earth here in this geography of the book of Revelation. And then we have heaven, which is practically in the middle, which is that lifted up place. Remember Isaiah chapter 2. The mountain of the house of the Lord will be lifted up in the last days, and all nations will flow unto it. Interesting figure of speech, because if a mountain is lifted up, we saw some mountains yesterday. If a mountain is lifted up, nothing flows up to it. Everything flows down. But in this case, we're talking, obviously, figuratively. And in the midst of that earth, as we said, there is the heavenly place, or the holy place, the lifted up place, which belongs to God. Also, I would suggest, sometimes called, or a portion thereof called in the book of Revelation, God's throne, the temple, and the altar. This very place where God has said in times past, I will put my name there. And we know that when Jesus returns, the first thing he does, or one of the first things he does, is to come to this very place, to stand on the Mount of Olives, and the glory of God is returning to his city, and all events begin to take place and happen more and more quickly. Now, back to page 27, and just we want to look at some of these passages in Revelation that speak of heaven almost as though it were a place that we should be concerned with. On a natural level, we obviously don't find ourselves going to heaven. We can't stand in heaven. We can't be called to go to heaven. It has to have some symbolic significance. Chapter 4 is really the beginning of this. After this, I looked. I'm at the middle of page 27, just reading from the notes here. After this, I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven, and the first voice which I heard was, as it were, of a trumpet talking with me, which said, come up hither, and I will show you the things that shall be hereafter. And immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne was set in heaven, and one sat on the throne. We can visualize that as the literal heaven where God sits, but we can also visualize it, and Isaiah chapter 6 with its picture of the glory of the Lord filling the temple, and Ezekiel 2 with its picture of the prophet coming into the temple, help us to see this possibility that the temple itself in Jerusalem was the heavenly place where the glory of God dwelt. That was true in the past. It will be true once again as Jesus is returning or has returned to the earth. We're not minding here too much about precise chronology or order of things. We're talking about symbols to see if they work. Down to chapter 11, I think we're into a very interesting category here. Chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. There was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. But the court which is without the temple, leave out and measure it not. It is given unto the Gentiles. The holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. It looks as though Gentile peoples will be trampling under the holy city of God. But in the very midst of that, at some point, the temple itself, which was in the heart of Jerusalem, the old city, we can see the place today. There have been battles fought in small measure about that place just in the last year. In the very midst of that place, there will be protection and safety for God's people. We go down to chapter 11 and verse 12. This is spoken to the witnesses who were testifying against this evil power that is treading down the city for 42 months, and then the witnesses are killed. And for 3.5 days, their dead bodies lie in the streets of that great city where our Lord was crucified, Jerusalem. And then they're raised up. They're given life. And a voice comes to them, chapter 11 and verse 12. They heard a great voice from heaven, saying, come up hither. And they ascended up to heaven. Did they go to heaven literally? Will they go to heaven literally? Or are they called up to a heavenly place? Well, if we turn forward, two chapters in Revelation are, for your convenience, if we turn the next page in the notes, in chapter 14, verses 1 to 3, we find, I would suggest, those very witnesses. I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters, and the voice of a great thunder, and I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps, and they sang, as it were, a new song before the throne. Notice the different phrases that are all used interchangeably in Revelation 14, it would seem. The Lamb is standing on Mount Zion. There are those who are standing before the throne, and a voice comes out from heaven to those who are standing there. It looks as though all these places are the very same, that we're standing on Mount Zion, which is God's throne at this point, as it was in the past, and the voice that comes forth from heaven, from the heavenly place, is the voice of blessing to those who are standing there. And this is the place to which those faithful witnesses were called after they were raised from the dead. In chapter 12, another very interesting prophecy, it's the top of page 28. How do we deal with this? There was a war in heaven. Two powers are antagonizing with one another about who will control heaven. And the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. So this dragon, this beast, I think in chapter 12 it says he has 7 heads and 10 horns. We're making connections with the other beasts that are mentioned. Is actually dwelling and ruling in heaven. What does that mean? Could it possibly mean controlling the Temple Mount, controlling the old city of Jerusalem, oppressing and trampling underfoot, words of chapter 11, the holy city for 42 months? Remember all those passages we looked at yesterday, those where it would suggest that the great war, the great conflict of the last days between Arabs and Israel has to do with a special holy place. And it's a holy war. The Arabs will be fighting against God and against God's people, as if to say, where is your God now? And how can he save you now that we've taken over the very heart of your nation and we've destroyed your sovereignty? Look around and find your God, and he isn't there. It's a very contemptuous sort of thing that comes across time after time. Aha! Even the sanctuary itself is in our possession now. That's what those words say in several of the Psalms and in Ezekiel. But the glory of God will be revealed, and this great beast that is in the heavenly place will be cast out of heaven. And who will take its place? The Lamb stands on Mount Zion, and around him are gathered those who have come out of great tribulation, who have perhaps been killed for their faith, and are raised from the dead, and are called up to that heavenly place to be with Jesus. Again, we're not talking about details of chronology or order of events here. I'm trying to establish what I think are some interesting pictures and patterns and themes. So a war in heaven is perhaps a war at Jerusalem about the Temple Mount, and the Arab oppressors are cast out of Jerusalem, and they have just a little time before they're completely destroyed, if we read through Revelation chapter 12. And then in chapter 15, I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, 7 angels having the 7 last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of God. And after that I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. Way up in the sky somewhere, or in a heavenly place where God's temple of his tabernacle has been established before. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God, as though those who were there were being protected from everything that might happen around them. We're back to chapter 14, remember? The Lamb standing on Mount Zion with 144,000. Jews, certainly, and probably also the great multitude out of all nations who have been gathered together. And there they are protected. And as we say in the notes, it is from the heavenly temple mount that God's judgments are sent out against those on the earth or in the land, as the glory of God's kingdom spreads out to incorporate more and more territory and to destroy those enemies that are resisting it. Until those judgments are finished, no one else may enter that temple mount except those who have already been redeemed. And that's a paraphrase of Revelation 15, verse 8. Into chapter 19, and this I think deserves reading because an interesting point arises from this that I could say I discovered or occurred to me quite recently in some discussion. Revelation 19, verses 11 through 16. I have to assume, in interest of time, that we're generally familiar with the context and some of the stories, some of the pictures in the book of Revelation, so we can't spend a lot of time establishing the context in each case. But obviously this is a kingdom passage that we see in Revelation 19, beginning with verse 11. I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes are like a flame of fire, and so forth, clad in a robe dipped in blood. His name is the Word of God. And the armies of heaven, verse 14, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure. I'm stressing those words. We're going to come back to them. Followed him on white horses. Verses 15 and 16 describe the kingdom of God being established with divine power. Now, arrayed in fine linen, white and clean. I had thought before that this was a picture of the angels, because obviously this army was coming out of heaven, so it must be coming down to the earth. So it must be when Christ first returns, before any of the saints have had a chance to be gathered to him or glorified. But let's see if it suits something else. Turn back to chapter 19 and verse 8, just six short verses before. And here we have the bride who has made herself ready. And to her it was granted that she should be clothed with fine linen, bright and pure. For the fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints. And then just a few verses further on, the armies coming with Christ, going out into the earth to bring the judgments of God and bring peace and righteousness, are clothed in fine linen, white and pure, which represents the righteousness, not necessarily righteous actions so much as the covering of righteousness that has been provided for the bride of Christ. We think, somehow we're up there in heaven, coming down? No, but the picture changes if we see the heaven to be the heavenly place. Because now what we're seeing is the 144,000, whether symbolic or literal, Jews and Gentiles together joined with Christ, and now this great army assembled in the heavenly place goes forth and spreads out its influence to destroy enemies, however that's done, and to set up God's kingdom in the land and on beyond its borders until the whole globe is covered with the glory of God. So that helps us to see who these soldiers, this army is. This army is really the bride of Christ that has been glorified. And one more similar point in chapter 21, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. We've talked about that passage, borrowed from Isaiah, used in the New Testament. I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven. How much careful reasoning and bringing to bear of various passages has been used to try to explain how it could be that the saints, the glorified saints, New Jerusalem, could come down out of heaven to the earth. Maybe we could make it fit, but I always thought it was very difficult. However, if once again, heaven doesn't mean someplace way up there, but it means that place which is lifted up, the heavenly place on the earth where the saints have been gathered together and glorified. Now, in Revelation 21, in this culmination, we see coming down from that heavenly place, the New Jerusalem, which is not so much a city on that mountain as it is a group of people who constitute that city. But they don't stay there. They go forth into the earth so that ultimately the glory of God covers the whole earth. Erects in the first place the whole land and then beyond, so that all enemies are subjugated and the glory of God. I think we're going to have to do bits and pieces of this. I'll point out certain things to you. We'll come back to it tomorrow to finish up. I'll just read a bit of the text there at the top of page 30. References to Babylon in the Apocalypse. Genesis 15, 18 to 21 helps to set the stage for Bible prophecy. The land of the Middle East between the Euphrates and the Nile, between Assyria, Babylon on the northeast, or north and east, and Egypt on the south and west. In this arena, Israel was, in the past and will be in the future beset by its enemies in the last days, the 10 kings of the land and the beast and the dragon, while a remnant is being developed who repent and turn to God. Then, in response to their prayers for deliverance, God judges their enemies, delivers Jerusalem, and redeems his people Israel. And that, you might say, is a bird's eye view of what is happening, or what I am suggesting will happen, as described in much of the book of Revelation. Assuming this scenario, it is to be expected that Babylon and the Euphrates will be the subjects of references in the book of Revelation, and it is so. In Revelation chapter 9, there is described, first of all, a great army of locusts. In Hebrew, the word for locust is almost identical and is connected with, etymologically, the word for Arab. A great army of locusts coming out of the abyss, the deep place of the earth. Brother Thomas himself suggested the abyss was the Arabian Peninsula, although he related it in a historical context to something that happened in earlier times where the Arab hordes, the Muslim hordes, were coming out of the abyss against the Roman Empire. And that was true. In a last day's sense, I'm suggesting out of that same abyss come other great locust hordes. It's really the book of Joel. And in the book of Joel, those locust hordes are directed, obviously, against the nation of Israel. And we can see the players in position today for how that could happen again out of the great abyss. Saudi Arabia and all of that area. Great hordes come out and overflow the land of Israel. Secondly, following right up with that, I think that was the fifth, trumpet, right? And in the sixth trumpet, I'm relying on memory here and I'm expecting most of you to do the same somewhat. In the sixth trumpet, there is a great destroying power which is bound at the Euphrates River. I need another map here to portray that. Let's just put this one back up here. And see how everything involves this area if we read more literally the book of Revelation. Coming out of the abyss, great locust hordes, and they sweep out into the land of Israel. That's what Joel is about. And obviously this is patterned after Joel. We can choose to interpret it in a different way, but we realize it is patterned after the prophecy of Joel. And then a great army which is bound at the Euphrates River, which is the nation of Iraq, that army is prepared and presumably set forth or sent forth on a similar errand against this land, the land of Israel. When we look at it on a map, if we allow ourselves the possibility that these are literal designations in the last days, then certain ideas occur to us. In Revelation 16, lost my handy text here, but here it is again. In Revelation 16 and verse 12, the Euphrates River is mentioned once again. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up. Leave aside the last phrase. We may get to that tomorrow. The waters of the Euphrates River being dried up. Divine judgments poured out on the Euphrates River, causing it to dry up. Now, into the next several chapters, there are references to Babylon and to the fall of Babylon. And this is a point I think that we can look at for a couple of minutes because it's significant when we're considering the possible geography of the book of Revelation. Historically, the city of Babylon, I hope that's somewhat visible, the city of Babylon was on the banks of the Euphrates River. Historically, what happened after the days of Nebuchadnezzar and the days of Belshazzar was that Babylon gave way to Medo-Persia, and the armies of the enemies of Babylon entered the city. They didn't totally destroy the city, they captured the city. But the way they entered the city, and this is recounted to us by secular history, it's hinted at in Jeremiah 50, verse 38, and Jeremiah 51, verse 36. The way they captured the city, apparently, history suggests, was they diverted the flow of the Euphrates River, and they entered into the city by stealth, that city that was considered to be impregnable, and Babylon fell. Now, we come to the book of Revelation. We say to ourselves, to what does the Euphrates River refer? To what does Babylon refer? Various possibilities. But what we should have, it seems to me, is some connection between the Euphrates River and the city of Babylon. Just as the drying up of the Euphrates originally led to the fall of Babylon, so it would seem that there ought to be just that cause and effect relationship in the prophecy, because the ideas come so close together. In Revelation 16, the Euphrates River is dried up. In the next few chapters, we see in some detail the fall of Babylon. So, if the Euphrates River is identifying a geographical area, and if Babylon is referring to a geographical area, then the two are actually together today. There's no great military power in Babylon, but, and you can think as you please about this, and certainly that's true of anything we're saying, in the last few years there has been the rebuilding of a city of Babylon, something like a tourist attraction, but also as a way by which Saddam Hussein has attempted to link himself with Nebuchadnezzar and with the old glories of the Babylonian Empire. And on the very banks of the Euphrates River today, in the heart of Iraq, there is being constructed a new city of Babylon. So far as I can tell, it survived a lot of the bombing that went on, just as Saddam Hussein survived. Just quite recently, I read a news report to the effect that Saddam Hussein had met with all of his ministers and his cabinet at the city of Babylon. And there they had some council meetings and determining what to do and how to run the government. And I would suggest specifically what they're going to do about the Israeli problem and so forth. So, the book of Revelation does talk about Babylon to some extent. We have to try to figure out in each context or each possible time period of fulfillment who that Babylon could be. I'm not going to suggest that there is no connection between the Babylon of Revelation and the Roman Catholic Church. There may well be in certain time periods. There may well have been a historical connection and a prophetic intention there. I am trying to concentrate on the last days and suggest maybe there are other ways of looking at it too that can blend together and present a fuller picture. So Revelation chapter 9 talks about the Euphrates. Revelation 16 talks about the Euphrates. First of all, there is a great, just to paraphrase and summarize, a great army is at the river Euphrates. And then finally, the Euphrates River is dried up and Babylon falls. Now that's about as straightforward and simple a statement of what the last few chapters of the book of Revelation are saying as I could imagine. I tried to say that without coloring it. But Euphrates River and Babylon are there. The Euphrates River dries up. Babylon falls. First of all, an army in that area of the Euphrates, presumably where Babylon is too, is going forth against God's people and wreaking great havoc. And finally, there are judgments upon Babylon and Babylon falls. Let's look at one more point here, bottom of page 30, that is going to relate to this some way, somehow, as we move along. Who is the beast? I think once or twice this week, Psalm 49 has already been quoted. Man that is in honor and understandeth not is like the beast that perish. And Ecclesiastes chapter 3, noted there also, says man has no preeminence over a beast. I think that explains to us why beasts are used as symbols in Daniel and Revelation and even in some of the other Old Testament prophets, because beasts were degraded. It almost seems as though it's a wrong way to talk about the beast of the field, to compare them to men. But the Bible does in some cases. They're beasts of prey. They're the predatory animals that prey upon others, and man can be like that beast if he preys upon his fellow men and seeks to enslave them and destroy them. So that's the general significance of the use of beast in Daniel and Revelation. Now, at the bottom of page 30, there is a quotation of several verses from Daniel chapter 4. I asked myself once the question, pondering the book of Revelation, this beast has the number of a man. He must be a man. I ask myself, is there any man in the Bible that is specifically, not in these general terms like Psalm 49 and Ecclesiastes 3, but in specific terms, is there any man in the Bible who is called a beast that we can actually identify? We know who that man is. And yes, there is at least one. I may have missed others, but there is one that is very significant to this discussion. Daniel chapter 4, those verses that are at the bottom of the page, let his, that is Nebuchadnezzar's heart, be changed from man's. Let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him, and they will drive you, Nebuchadnezzar, from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and they shall make you eat grass as the ox, and so forth all the way down through those other verses. Nebuchadnezzar was the beast. And that suits a lot of what Daniel has to say, because Nebuchadnezzar was the head of that image. He was the beginning of the kingdoms of men that oppressed Israel. And so we say, if that image stands again in the last days, and there may be various components to that image, and we're told that it is a beast, and there are horns, these 10 horns or 10 kings attached to it, is there someone like a Nebuchadnezzar who would be a beast? There is, in fact, very interestingly, as we probably have realized in the last year or two, a man who still exists in the Middle East, who suffered temporary defeats, but still holds on to power, who desperately would desire the destruction of the nation of Israel, who would like to see himself as the leader of all the Arab nations, and who pictures himself as the reincarnation, not so much in a religious or literal sense, but the reincarnation in a spiritual sense of everything that Nebuchadnezzar was. In fact, he has had medallions struck of himself, standing as though he were side by side with the great king, Nebuchadnezzar. Look at me. I am the new Nebuchadnezzar. And the two great things that Nebuchadnezzar did were, he created the first great empire in the Middle East, binding together all the Arab peoples under his authority. And the second great thing he did was, he was responsible for the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 B.C., There is a man in the Middle East today who calls himself a Nebuchadnezzar who would like to do those very things with the 10 nations that exist in that area. It's just about time to quit. They're going to ring the bell, I'm sure, in 2 minutes. I could embark upon another section, but we wouldn't get very far. What I'd like to start with tomorrow is page 31, the bottom, and page 32. If you would like, and I know time is always at a premium, but if you would like to spend a little time looking at the chart on page 32, if you're interested in the nuts and bolts, if what really turns you on about Revelation is talking about beasts and dragons and heads and horns, what I've attempted to do here is summarize in a chart form, a tabular form, some of the possibilities of these various nations and how we can link together portions of Daniel's prophecies and portions of Revelation, as well as Psalm 83, Genesis 15, and other lists of nations, and make sense of it. I'm not saying this is the last word, but I'm saying it's something we will try to consider tomorrow. It might help if you look at that a little bit ahead of time. Homework assignment then, if you feel like it, middle of page 31 to the end, and page 32 and the top of page 33, look at that and you'll do me a favor, because then I won't spend as much time with that, and we'll move into the summaries that I would hope to do on the last day.